Hey, folks, I'm Denise Howell. You're looking at David from Dual Core, who is one of our great panelists for today. We've also got David Levine from Hearsay Culture. We're going to talk about fracking, tracking, and middle finger attacking. We're going to Skype as hard as we can, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 218, recorded July 5th, 2013. Hack all the things. Hi there, I'm Denise Howell, and you are joining us for This Week in Law. We are so excited to have you here. We've got a great show today. We're all going to go by our name today, I think, because one of our panelists is David from Dual Core Music. Hello, David.
Hey there. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So David was just confirming before we started the show, one of his DJ names is Int 80. We may call him Int 80. We may call him Dual Core. You know, throw out whatever DJ name you want to go by today, David, and we'll try and honor it as best we can. We're thrilled to have you because we've been talking a lot about music issues lately. Pandora has been much in the news, so we'd love to get your take as both a musician and a programmer and someone who hacks around quite a bit with technology on the whole mess of the music industry these days. So welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We've got another David with us today, so hence the need for DJ names and disintermediation of Davids. David Levine from Hearsay Culture is joining us once again. Hi, David.
Hi, Denise, and hi, Evan. Thanks for having me back. Thrilled to be here.
So what do you think, Dave? Nice. What shall we dub you for the day?
Yeah, my KZSU DJ name that I used rarely was D Nights. So if you want to go that route, you can try. I have not used that since probably 2007, but feel free. I'm happy to revive it here on This Week in Law.
Perfect. My usual fellow DJ is joining us today, Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois, and the Info Law Group. Ev McCrunchy, or I don't know.
Yeah,
you have to pick your own.
I think we just got to make it up on the fly, but just to keep it simple, you can call me Evan until we come up with something better. It's good that we don't need any disambiguation coming this direction. But really looking forward to our conversation. Happy to be here, and so it ought to be a good time. You know, here kind of reeling from celebrating our nation's independence. I bet this will be a nice conversation. So happy to be joining you.
All right. Well, since we've got a musician with us here, let's start out on the entertainment front. So, Dual Core, the Pandora saga continues. First, we had Pink Floyd up in arms about Pandora and the royalties it's playing or not playing. Now we've got David, yet another David Lowery, who has done some math and decided that for over a million plays of his song Low, he as a songwriter is only getting paid $16 and change by Pandora. And he's not happy about this. He says it's, you know, less than he would make from a t-shirt sale. There's some quibbling with his math out there and others who question whether he would be getting so low a number and have come up with numbers in the at least hundreds of dollars that the songwriters, the complicating matters is the fact he has to split his songwriting royalties with people he co-wrote with. But a few hundred dollars is somebody's mathematical guess. Either way, there is concern about the royalty structure for internet radio and how it jibes or fails to with terrestrial radio and satellite radio. And Dual Core, I'm wondering about your take on that.
Well, I think it's an interesting like aspect, right? Because anybody can like kick up their own like radio stream or station in this case, right? So like I can just like run a shoutcast server off of my own box. I can like spin up a VPS, like whatever. So I can make like tracking of things like very difficult. As far as like royalties and stuff like that, I don't know. Like I don't really have a particular take on it, because the way that we sell our music is like we just get like direct money. Like iTunes takes its chunk, of course. And like, you know, we sell through like Bandcamp and stuff like that where we get a bigger cut. But for the most part, like we don't really worry about the money side of things. And I don't know. It's just like it's not something that I've given a lot of thought to, because I'm not concerned with it. It's my actual like qualm with Pandora is more so about the barriers that they put in place to get your music on Pandora, as opposed to like what they actually pay out.
Well, tell us about that. Are you having trouble in that area?
Yeah, absolutely. They have these like arbitrary requirements about your album has to be available like on Amazon as a physical CD, and it has to be like labeled a certain way and like set up. It's like it's this really like weird set of requirements in order to get your music on Pandora. And so like from time to time we have like people contacting us like via Twitter or Facebook and saying, you know, hey, like why isn't your music on Pandora? And like, because we don't have a physical CD to sell through Amazon. And it's like it's a really strange requirement, right? Like we all listen to like music digitally, so like I don't understand the need for like a physical like token that needs to be sold. So yeah, it's kind of strange.
Yeah, you would think that a company that is sort of a new media company and exists online until recently when they bought the radio station, would have a different approach toward having to have a physical product in order to get played.
Yeah, it just doesn't, like, it's this weird, like, cognitive dissonance, right? You'd think, like, I could just put my MP3s up or send them whatever file format that they want. And like, they could use some sort of validation, like, hey, are you on iTunes? Yes. Okay. Like, or whatever, like whatever like digital validation they want to do. But like, I am totally at a loss for like the understanding for a need of a physical CD. It's actually really interesting too, because I've had like Pandora actually reach out to me and be like, oh yeah, like hit us up and we'll help you like get taken care of. But like, they haven't done anything. So it's, I don't know, like Pandora is like not high on my list. Like, and it's really interesting to hear, like, usually Spotify is the streaming service that people go by for like credibility. Like I've met numerous people where they're like, oh yeah, and like, this is David. And like, he makes rap music. He's in this group called Dual Core. They're legit. They're on Spotify. And like, that's like the validation. And like, Spotify doesn't require a physical CD from us.
Right. What other services carry your music?
iTunes, Amazon, I think we're on RDO, the Zune store or whatever they're calling it now, Xbox Live, I guess. Bandcamp's like our big mm-hmm. one, because like they're out here in San Francisco and they give us like a lot of like really rad stats on the back end. So like we when we did our release of our fifth album, like we went through Bandcamp and it was like awesome to do that. And like I like Bandcamp a lot because you can just stream the whole song for everything, so you can get like a full feel like of like the real like try before you buy, and so you know like exactly what you're getting when you end up buying something through Bandcamp.
Yeah, and it's a great name too. I hadn't heard of that one. So,
oh yeah,
good.
They're awesome.
Good call and, there.
The other thing I like about Bandcamp is you can get your music in any format. There's no DRM at all, so you're never like tied mm-hmm. to a particular device. You can move your content across devices, which is a huge issue for me. I think like that's part of the problem, like why people face issues with piracy when they try to lock their content. And so like the fact that like you can pick your format and there's no DRM, you can move it across whatever device. Like that's what I really like about Bandcamp.
So you it sounds like have no DRM on your music at all, and you're not concerned about piracy the way that maybe some older or more traditional recording artists might be.
Correct. We actually have like really good experience with piracy. Like at a lot of shows, people will just come up to me and say like, hey, like I've pirated your music and I really liked it, so like here's $20. And like there's like no overhead cost for us at that point. You know, like it doesn't cost us to sell a CD. There's no like iTunes taking money out of the middle. It's awesome. It's just like free money basically. And like on top of that, like piracy serves this like huge promotional service for us. Like people like find our music on BitTorrent and then they listen to it and then they'll like either go buy it or come to a show or like whatever. And it's awesome because like it's a way for us to like just like provide another avenue for access to our music that we like to make and like have people listen to. I've even had like people email me and do the same thing. Like, hey, like I'm never going to be near one of your shows. Like they're in other countries, and they'll say like, can I just like donate money to you somehow? And so like I actually have a subdirectory on our site, dualcoremusic.com/piracyworks, and then I make a page under that directory for each person that wants to donate to me. And then they're like, we just have like a PayPal button and like a little write-up for them, and they can like donate money to us, and it's awesome. It's like free money basically.
That's brilliant. Do you do anything on the licensing front? Do you use Creative Commons or anything else to help your music spread and get remixed and reused?
Not yet. I'm working on that. Unfortunately, like the other guy in my group is C64. He makes all the beats and does all the mixing and has all the real talent. Like rapping doesn't really require much talent, but like he does all the hard work, and he's kind of like a little more old school on the licensing side. So like while I would love to like kick all of our stuff over to Creative Commons, he kind of like doesn't want to deal with that stuff for his own reasons. And so I haven't really fought him on that. And it's not a battle that's particularly high on my priority list to fight with him. But at the same time, mm-hmm. we're never going to like chase anybody down and like prosecute them for piracy. So, you know, like we encourage people, like, or at least I encourage people to like share our music and stuff like that on whatever media that they see fit. You know, if you want to pass around a USB drive, or if you want to like zip up our MP3s and like upload them and email them somewhere, put them on Dropbox, like whatever, like we're never going to like come after people for doing that. I think it's rad that people listen to our music and share it.
All right. Well, I hope it doesn't get you too sideways with your co-member there. David Levine, I have a question about getting back to Pandora for a second. One of the things that struck me recently is the fact that terrestrial radio is exempted from paying performers royalty payments, whereas internet radio is not. And the justification for that seems to be that the performers get a lot of exposure, spreading the word kind of thing that David was just talking about, a lot of promotion for their music through terrestrial radio play, and that there's somehow the notion that that's not there with internet radio. Do you think that this is something that legislatively might be adjusted at some point? Because I think that assumption is just wrong, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge. You know, the notion that a recording artist or even a songwriter, although to a lesser extent, would generate revenue simply, you know, by virtue of the fact that a song or recording that author is involved with is on the radio is an issue that goes back to the Piola scandals back in the 50s, right? And so paying off DJs to play your song is something that not just you know, went after radio itself and caused changes in how we regulate radio stations, but also copyright law. You know, I think what David was just talking about with regard to his revenue model, of course, is a revenue model that largely didn't exist prior to the commercial internet. And now that you have the ability to create your songs, create other works of authorship, and then distribute them in new ways, is challenging to a law which is still built largely around technological assumptions and business model assumptions from the 70s, with a good amount, to be sure, of updating in the 90s as a result of the DMCA. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I saw an interesting article in Bloomberg Businessweek about this issue where Jack Lerner from USC was actually saying, no, you know, in fact, Pandora pays too much because a lot of the concern is still around this being, although we've gotten used to it, or at least many people have, a nascent technology. And so if you up the royalty rates on internet radio, and this issue's come up generally with internet radio, I mean, Radio Paradise, which is another internet radio station, has dealt with this issue also. And there's been legislation around it. So to answer your question, yeah, I think the assumption is somewhat dated. You know, if you're listening to Pandora on your headphones, you're one person using the Pandora algorithm versus the notion of terrestrial radio being anyone who's tuning in. Whether that translates to more or less ears, I think, is a very big question. Either way, business models like David's is one that copyright law doesn't deal with very well.
Yeah, and it's not just more or less listens, but more or less purchases. You know,
right.
I think that's it's, I think, very hard to quantify how many people hear a song on the radio and go out and buy it. Although there's some radio technology. I've seen things in cars where, you know, you can turn your listen into a direct purchase. It links you right into iTunes there. But I think in the case of Pandora, it's much easier to see and track what kind of purchase activity the users are engaged in. Although people, I think, and I'm a good example of this, might hear something on Pandora and go buy it elsewhere. And so that's difficult to track. But
well, yeah, along those lines, you know, one of the broad issues that, you know, we're dealing with generally with intellectual property reform is a lack of evidence to establish what the damages are or what kind of damage there is when, in fact, copyright infringement takes place. And so I'm not trying to hijack the discussion, but right at the international level and in other places, right, the copyright entertainment industries have made the argument that they're losing enormous amounts of revenue through copyright infringement. While there's certainly infringement going on, the real question is how many actual sales are being lost? Is someone who's going to or does pirate or copy or infringe a recording actually going to go out and buy it if they don't have the option to pirate it? And that's a real interesting evidentiary question. And because we don't have a lot of evidence that are able to show this is an actual lost sale, i.e. the person who is not buying in the traditional model, but rather is listening and not paying, is someone who would have purchased, is a very real challenge. And so the lack of evidence to quantify in dollars and cents what's being lost, I think, makes it very difficult for us to figure out what copyright law and therefore what the royalty rate should be.
Evan, what do you think about this notion that performers don't get royalties from terrestrial radio, but they do from things like Pandora? You know, there's a lot of concern and hand-wringing over whether musicians' royalties are high enough. It seems to me like they might be dropped down to what terrestrial is based on that erroneous assumption about distribution and promotion.
Yeah, I think we're definitely onto something here when we're talking about this problem of measuring both the quantities of people who are actually consuming the content and, even more importantly, the people who are or aren't buying the content. And I think that actually we have every reason to be optimistic about the future on this point, because terrestrial radio, of course, has been with us for however many decades now, and we've never been able to really get accurate measurements. There's only been approximations of reach and market effectiveness and all that, because there's no way to tell, to evaluate and count the listener's engagement with the music. We can only get approximations. But with digital distribution modes, those ones that we have now and the ones that will be coming over the next few years and, you know, heretofore, you know, forever, new innovation in distribution models will be coming our way. There's every bit of reason to think that we'll be more effectively, or we'll be able to more effectively measure the user's engagement. And even perhaps to the point of being able to more readily ascertain whether or not the acquisition of a so-called pirated copy caused a lost sale to occur. For example, if we go to if the whole world becomes a file locker and we don't carry around music with ourselves anymore, but everything's stored in a hosted service in the cloud somewhere, then one can measure the user's engagement with that pretty well. I'm setting aside all the privacy issues with this, but you can measure the user's engagement with that piece of content, match up with whether they purchased that, and make some assumptions, make some inferences as to whether or not that truly was a lost sale here. So as we move away from terrestrial radio and toward alternate, non-terrestrial radio modes of distribution, I think there's every reason for us to think that this problem will get more of this evidence that we're talking about, that David was saying that we're missing in all of this. And, that'll be the way to really get this resolved. And only then can we meaningfully talk about how copyright reform should go and what it should look like in all this. Because right now it's just such a mess. And, you know, I'm this close to just dropping out of the discussion on the large scale of Pandoran royalty rates and all this stuff, because it really has very little to do with copyright. It just has to do with business interests and the relative powers of the incumbents versus the purveyors and users of more disruptive technologies.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Although I suppose it has to do with copyright in that some of the royalty structure that we're saddled with today has been the result of settlement of lawsuits over various copyright concerns. So it comes into it obliquely, but I agree with you. It, at this point, everybody agrees there's a copyright interest. It's just how it's going to be compensated. Of course, internet radio is only one aspect of internet distribution of music that causes some concern in the music industry. How about this story? Concert pianist named Christian Zimmermann was performing in Essen, Germany, and walked off the stage, stormed off the stage, according to Mike Masnick, writing over at Tech Dirt, and I think he was reviewing a Guardian article of this occurrence, over the fact that one of the fans was holding up a smartphone in the audience. Now, the musician, the pianist here, can't have known whether the person was merely taking a picture or maybe it looked like they were taking a very long picture. So that's what clued him to the fact that there was video going on. When he came back on stage, he told the audience that YouTube is really hurting him, that it's keeping him from getting recording contracts because of his, if his songs are already on YouTube, he says, folks won't give him deals to record his music, I guess, because it's already out there. Now, Mike Masnick has a field day over the fact that, please, you know, don't tell me a grainy smartphone YouTube video is going to take the place of a professionally mastered recording. There's no way that this is denying you recording contracts. So he just has a healthy amount of disbelief about this. But I think, you know, it is a symptom of what might be happening with other artists, that their music is definitely being recorded and put out, perhaps with their tacit approval, perhaps without their approval. David, I think I know what your answer will be on this. You know, we want to get the word out about our music. We want fans to be enthusiastic about it. Do you sympathize at all with this pianist in Germany?
Nope, not at all. I think it's awesome when like fans record our stuff at shows. I kind of feel bad. Like I'll like freestyle at shows, and like when I, you know, freestyle live, it's awesome, and like in the moment it's fantastic, and then when I go back and watch it, I kind of facepalm a little bit. Like it's not as cool as I remembered it. But like there's definitely, you know, ways to like make money off of YouTube, and I think it's just like almost like the streaming radio stuff. It's just like figuring out how to use the business model correctly. I know, like from our perspective, we just had one of our friends, Colleen, did like all of our first album songs and put them up on YouTube for us. And so she did like some visualizations for the music, but it's just the music there. And so like that way, like we can get people to come to our YouTube channel and see our stuff, like our other videos, if they want to listen to like one of the songs, as opposed to like other people like uploading our songs, which we're also fine with. But like, you know, we would like to get those channel views instead. And so like what this guy, I think, could do is like one approach, instead of being angry at his fans, is maybe like contact his fans if he like goes on YouTube and like looks for videos of himself playing, and maybe say like, hey, like I really like this video that you shot, like would it be okay for like me to get a copy and like put it up on my channel and like, you know, give you credit for it or something like that. I mean, like A, that just comes off as a much better like personality, but B, like that way he can drive like views and eyes like to his YouTube channel where he can then like monetize that.
Right. David Levine, here's a law prof question for you. This is a Polish musician, and he was performing in Germany. So, and of course, we're dealing with YouTube, which is owned by a U.S. company. How does the DMCA come into all this? They can avail themselves of that, can't they?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I guess, you know, as a law professor, I should offer the disclaimers, which is that I'm not an expert in either Polish or German intellectual property law. You know, to the extent that a recording is placed on YouTube, right, you know, that you have to establish, obviously, that you have a copyright ownership over the recording. Now, you know, under U.S. law, an unauthorized recording of a performance, assuming that the performer owns the right to performance, which we should assume, is copyright infringement. And so, you know, the question, you know, I think becomes one of whether, again, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, whether we want to foreclose certain revenue models for artists that may not be the current way that many artists would perform, but that are still at least options. And while we may say, well, you know, your style of how you're going to generate revenue from your performance is archaic, and it deals with labels, and labels aren't the way of the future, and don't you see that you could actually generate more revenue by letting people do what you're doing? At the same time, right, you know, my concern would be, and I'm getting to the DMCA question, Denise, so I'll do it quickly. My concern would be that we don't shut down other legitimate ways for authors to make money, even if they're not optimal. And so finding that balance is always tricky. With regard to the DMCA, I mean, once a video is put up on YouTube and therefore it's accessible in the United States, I mean, the DMCA would come into play. The challenging issue would be whether the law in another jurisdiction says something different about the rights of authorship, although I suspect, without knowing for sure, that that this would generally be considered unauthorized and therefore a violation of the author's copyright.
Obviously, it's going to depend on what he was performing. I don't know that it says that he was performing original works, right? I mean, if he was a classical pianist.
And like I said, I mean, I'm making, assuming for the moment that the performer would have any rights on the performance himself, in terms of literally the performance, that's where the copyright issue would arise. But, you know, I think the challenging question here really is a question of whether we want to say that the current state of the law offers no sympathy for a performer like this saying that I can show you, or I believe that your infringement, I'm making that assumption, of my copyright is going to be a disincentive for a label, right, to sign me. And that's the way that I'm going to generate revenue or income from my creative work. I mean, that to me is, I think, the real challenging issue here. And while I'm certainly sympathetic and want copyright law to be modernized to reflect new business models and to not tether itself to a business model which is on a daily basis becoming more archaic, I also think that we need to be in a position to allow the law flexibility.
I wonder, you know, DualCore, maybe you could talk about this. You know, David Levine was just talking about the disincentive, you know, that the performer had in allowing these videos. And maybe he's just getting bad information, because the article here says that he's been told by producers and, music managers have told him, we're sorry that it's already been on YouTube. You know, maybe he's just getting bad information, and that's the wrong attitude from those managers that are coming through. You know, is there anything to that, DualCore?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can gauge, like, an artist's popularity, right? You could go by, like, Twitter followers, or you could go by, like, Facebook fans, or you could go by YouTube views. And so, like, if you go to YouTube and you, like, you know, like, you're somebody looking to sign an artist, and you go to YouTube and you search for that artist, even if the first video that comes up is not on their channel, but it's got over 9,000 views on it, you know, that's going to be like a metric that you can use to gauge their popularity. So like if somebody happens to take, you know, a good looking video and it goes viral or whatever, like that's definitely like a huge boost for that artist.
But I mean, clearly there's a bit of a cultural gulf here. Or there could be. Maybe I'm making too many assumptions. The only thing I know about this Christian Zimmerman is what I'm reading about in this article here. But he's a classical pianist. You are a rap artist. You know, how would you, you know, try to have a conversation across that cultural gulf and get somebody, if they're coming from the position of the classical world here and again, making a lot of assumptions that perhaps are unwarranted here, but just for the sake of our conversation, maybe this artist is just taking a more conservative view of things. Maybe it's a non-understanding of the norms of content distribution and, you know, the kind of the openness and the goodness about sharing and in the ways that you do. I mean, how would you have a conversation across that gulf to say, look, there's no need to be so conservative about this. There's actually this real benefit in taking a more modern and progressive approach, like what we're doing, for example.
I guess, you know, I would just aim to point out examples, right? You know, so it's like evidence wins, like as much evidence as you can provide, like for your side of the case, like that's how you win, right? So basically if I can like go to YouTube and be like, look, like Tayzonde made this video called Chocolate Rain and it's just like him singing and like he made, you know, X million dollars off of it, like whatever, like if I can like, you know, money talks and whatever walks. And so like, you know, if you can like show them the money, like, then they understand. And it's quite possible that he's just got, you know, management or whatever, like whoever's telling him that YouTube views or whatever are going to mess him up. Like maybe he's just working with the wrong people and, you know, like it's maybe he just needs to find somebody that knows how to do music distribution in the year 2013.
Gotcha.
All right. Let's, let's talk about some non-entertainment related copyright stories.
Oh, yeah, that was entertainment law that we were talking about, wasn't it?
No, it's really it was an awful lot of copyright. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much crossover, of course, with our little VCR bumper there. But this particular case doesn't involve any entertainment other than writing on the web, and the entertainment involved in reading about this dispute, women behaving badly. What happened here? There's a case pending in Massachusetts right now. It involves two women. Amy Tutor is the plaintiff, and Gina Crossley Corcoran is the defendant. And they write about things related to the world of midwives, and they got into a difference of opinion. On their sites, and they clearly dislike each other. Gina, back in December, posted a picture of herself flipping off Amy and put that on her blog and said, you know, maybe this will give her something else to think about or obsess over, I believe she said. And Amy, in turn, took the picture that now, again, the copyright wrinkle here is it was a picture of Gina, but I don't know who took the picture. And I haven't read whether that comes up in all the briefing or not. So it's generally the photographer that owns the rights in photos, not the subjects of them. But maybe this was a selfie. Let's assume for the sake of this case that it was. Amy took the picture and put it on her site. Gina sent a DMCA takedown notice, and now the two of them are embroiled in a lawsuit because Amy sued and said that under Section 512F of the Copyright Act is misuse of the DMCA. You know that I'm allowed, under some theory, fair use, I believe is what she would say, to use this photo, and yet you sent a DMCA takedown notice. And so this is on you now, Gina, to have to pay my attorney's fees and make this right. So this has now escalated from women arguing and flipping one another off to getting the MPAA and the EFF involved because they think this is an important point in the realm, and here's our crossover to the entertainment world, of DMCA notices in general. Because EFF thinks that Gina, if she had considered the issue of fair use would have known that she should not have filed that notice. And the MPAA, in turn, has argued and filed a brief with the court saying, consideration of fair use, are you going to require every person who files a DMCA notice to try and figure out the complicated laws of fair use and apply them in each individual circumstance before they file a DMCA notice? If you do that, that will gut the DMCA. So it's quite a conundrum. The court has not yet come down on this, but it's a pretty big deal because if the court sides with EFF, it's going to make it a lot easier to bring these counter notice lawsuits. Evan, what did you think when you read about all this?
Well, I think that, you know, this is an important issue. I mean, clearly the interests of the who is I lose track of who would be in which position here. The interest of the alleged infringer, the complainant, is important here if their fair use rights are being it wouldn't be the complainant. See, it gets so confusing because it's the party sending it. Yeah.
I mean, the alleged infringer.
Yeah.
And she filed the lawsuit claiming the DMCA notice was erroneous, should not have been sent.
Right. And it gets confusing because she was not the original copyright complainant. She was complaining that the DMCA notice was improperly sent. So let's just call them copyright holder and fair use proponent and all this stuff, I guess, something like that. So, yes, the fair use interest is important. And we've seen this in the Lens case, you know, with the Prince dancing baby video, the dancing baby, you know, with the Prince song playing in the background. And we did hear from a court that said, you know, that you should at least think about fair use before you send a DMCA takedown notice. But that still didn't advance 512F litigation from the plaintiff's perspective all that much. It's still pretty hard to win one of those cases. So, you know, there's no doubt that that's important because fair use is important and we don't want abusive DMCA takedown notices being sent. But in this case, I don't think that there's a very good argument here because I'm just jumping right to the finish line here. I don't think there's a very good fair use argument on these facts because there's this subtle distinction. And this is a mistake that people make very often, you know, of what is a criticism and commentary that is acceptable and becomes a fair use. And the criticism and commentary has to pertain to the work itself, not to the issue that the work is tending to deal with here. So republishing a photo of somebody flipping you off I think in these facts here is not necessarily a commentary on that photo. She wasn't like saying, oh, did you see how she framed the picture and that how the finger took up the most of the dominant third of the frame? You know, that's not the kind of reuse that we're talking about here. We're just talking about, hey, she gave me the bird. So, like I said, I'm just jumping to the finish line here saying I think that there aren't very good fair use facts here. So let's hope that the folks at EFF who are much more brilliant about this stuff than I am thought that through and make sure that they have good facts here to fight this, you know, all the way through as need be to get the issue resolved favorably.
Right. This could be a situation of bad facts making bad law. David Levine, what do you think both on the fair use point and on the argument the EFF is making that if there is a good fair use argument, that has to be considered before you go ahead and fire off a DMCA takedown?
Yeah, so and maybe to take that second question first, you know, the DMCA process, you know, requires good faith in sending a notice. Of course, good faith in law is an extremely nebulous standard, right? Good faith could be defined as, I'm going to turn a profit by doing this, so it's good faith. Or it could be business ethics, or in the case of law, it could be, you know, merit and things like that. I am concerned on that second question that the DMCA does require a good faith basis, and that it seems that the arguments that is being made with regard to that point, or VFF's argument, is that, well, you know, it's an open question and we don't have to consider everything, right? And so when the point is made, are you requiring that anyone sending a notice under DMCA has to go through the, and it is, complicated process of assessing whether there's a fair use claim? My answer to that question is absolutely, because otherwise you have a situation where, and, you know, chilling effects has, you know, made this point clear over and over again, where these notices pretty much end the discussion. If you don't have the resources to challenge the notice itself, you simply, fold your cards and go home. And fair use being the primary defense to a copyright infringement claim, I think it's critical in order to have that balancing in the DMCA that the courts not allow a party sending a notice to simply say, well, you know, I didn't have the resources or the ability to suss that out. And so my good faith belief is that I just assumed that fair use wouldn't apply. So on that one, I think it's pretty straightforward. I think Evan's point on whether this is a fair use is an important one as well, and it does jump to the merits of the case, which we may not necessarily get to. But you know, I do think that the context. I think Evan's right, but I think the context is important here. To the extent that it's part of a commentary or criticism, there might be an argument. On the other hand, and we've seen that issue arise in situations involving things like music, right? And so in presidential campaigns, in fact, the McCain campaign took this position pretty strongly that we can use songs in our campaign stops because we're using them in their political context. So I do think that that's a tricky question. I guess I'm a little more sympathetic to EFF's position, but I definitely don't think it's a slam dunk.
Yeah, I read the MPAA's brief, which was written by Munger Toll's lawyers in L.A., and I would think that I would be more sympathetic for EFF's position here, too. I'm wearing my EFF T-shirt, although you guys can't see it right now because we lost my video. I tend to be sympathetic to most EFF positions, but I thought the MPAA brief was pretty persuasive here and that there's going to be a pretty high burden on rights holders to have to do what is a difficult analysis in the best of circumstances for courts in each individual case to try and run through that kind of an analysis before sending off a DMCA request or face the pretty severe consequences under 512F is a lot to ask. But there definitely should be something, as you point out, David, the statute wants the notices to be sent in good faith. So maybe the facts of this case are just not the best one to test this out on, although they are entertaining facts. Dual Core, David, I'm guessing that the second half of your duo would be more likely to send DMCA takedown notices about your music than you would. But I'm wondering, if you have a horse in this race, what do you think about this? Do you think that rights holders should have to pause and consider and perhaps do some legal analysis before they fire off a DMCA notice?
I'm not a lawyer, and I kind of come into the whole like copyright situation with like a slightly different approach. As your viewers can probably see, I have a Jolly Roger pirate flag back behind me, and I hack computers for a living, and I have a song that goes "Drink all the booze, hack all the things," and basically like my like concept of stuff is that if you put something up on the internet, it's totally liable to be like copied and like republished somewhere else. Even just using a computer, like boiling down to like simple assembly instructions, there's like a move instruction that moves data from one register into another register. It literally makes a copy of that data. And so like anything that goes up on the internet, like I just automatically assume like it's going to get like copied and posted somewhere else. I don't know, like, I know that the law is like very complex about all that stuff and everything. And I just like don't care. I just know how computers work. And so like, that's my take on it.
I was wondering if Evan had anything more about the midwives to share with us.
No, I mean, with midwifery, I'm sure we could go on and say some intriguing things. But I guess when Dual Core has a pirate flag, he means it. Just to be commended for that.
true story. And if I could just kick in one other item about DMCA stuff, there's a really rad project out there called DoD.net. And it's actually like this set of servers that are like spanned across the world. And you can like host stuff on DoD.net. And so basically, like if you get a DMCA takedown notice for your content, they basically take it off of the server that's in like the infringing region, right? So like their US servers would like remove that content, but it's still accessible through the internet and it's just being hosted somewhere else where it's not causing a copyright violation in that particular area or hasn't been levied for one yet. So even like with DMCA abuse and like takedowns and all that stuff, like there's still like plenty of legal ways to like keep your content up on the internet, like regardless.
Yep. And people seem to find those however and whenever they can. Let's go ahead and make our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, midwives. This story that we've just been discussing is a great example of why we think you should be able to get continuing legal education for this show in various jurisdictions. And if you think so too and want to take a crack at it, we have some information over on the twit.tv wiki for the various states if you're a lawyer and you want to meet your continuing legal education requirements. We drop these passphrases into the show so that you can demonstrate in some states there's a requirement that you have to be able to show that you actually listened to or watched a show like this. So that's why we do this. And people in other industries sometimes too submit for continuing education credit. So we'd love to hear from you about how that's going. And we wish you all the best because we certainly find the show educational when we have such great panelists on as we do this week, week in and week out, and talk about the kinds of issues that we do. Let's move on to another interesting copyright dispute. This time in the question of photographs, I guess, you know, the DMCA story also involved a photograph. This one, though, came out differently than I would have expected it to. And it seems to be because the plaintiffs kind of swung for the bleachers on this, Evan, where they could have taken a more conservative approach. You wrote this up on Internet Cases. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes, this is a situation where a professional photographer was watching TV back in the spring, early summer of 2010 and saw her photo in an iPhone commercial for the iPhone 3GS, which was what was current at that time. And she filed suit. She had a timely registration for her photo, which means that she's entitled, if she so elects, to get statutory damages for this infringement, plus the recovery of her costs and attorney's fees. So there's every good reason for her to file a copyright lawsuit. But given the fact that the defendant is Apple and that Apple has made a few, gazillion dollars selling iPhones, her first approach was to not seek statutory damages, which could go up to 150 grand, but to get actual damages based on a calculation of the indirect profits that Apple enjoyed because of the use of this photo. And that's a very difficult evidentiary proposition to put on the table, to try to pursue, to try to tie the causal connection, or to try a causal connection between a defendant's use of a photo in an advertisement, or any piece of content in an advertisement, and how much money they got because of that. There's a famous statement from Judge Posner here in the Seventh Circuit. If you're going after GM for copyright infringement, you don't necessarily put GM's financial records and see what their net profit was selling cars. You've got to tie it to how the actual a piece of content, relates to those profits, and there's an initial burden on the plaintiff that has to be met, and then the defendant comes back and can kind of winnow that down. So, in this situation, the court found that the plaintiff didn't do a good enough job to make that causal connection between any profits that Apple enjoyed from the sale of the iPhone 3GS with the use of this particular photo, which was up on the screen for 5 seconds out of the 30-second commercial. It struck the plaintiff's claims, in as much as that she was asking for actual damages to, you know, because of these indirect profits. So that's all well and good, and it makes for a good headline title to a blog post that court sides with Apple on this copyright issue. But I think probably the more important, more subtle point about this is that it doesn't mean that Apple has gotten away with copyright infringement here using this photographer's photo in this album. The question of liability, of whether or not there really was infringement, is not on the table in this decision, which means that there could still be a finding of liability on Apple's part and injunctive relief, which probably wouldn't have any effect now. We're talking about 3 years ago, a photo that Apple certainly won't have any interest in using anymore, most likely. So injunctive relief would not have much of a value anyway. But also the question of statutory damages is still on the table here as well. And so the court very well may find or hold that that the plaintiff is entitled to some statutory damages here. So interesting story, and it shows the difficulties that copyright plaintiffs can face when going after looking for these actual damages. It's a very difficult calculation to make, and often quite obscure and inscrutable how to make these causal connections. But an interesting story nonetheless.
Do you think there's a chance that the court could shut her out on damages because she's already pursued one theory? Will they let her fall back to statutory damages at this point?
Yeah, you can elect statutory damages at any time. If certain conditions are met, you know that the registration is valid. And if it was made in the appropriate period of time, either within the first 3 months after publication, if the infringement began, I mean, it's kind of this weird little timing here. It has to be either before the infringement began or within 3 months of the first publication of the work. So, yeah, I don't see any reason why the court would shut her out on statutory damages for those reasons. And as we're very clear, as the Copyright Act is very clear that $750 is a minimum. So if there's a finding of liability, I don't see why she wouldn't get those. Plus her costs and attorney's fees, which could be pretty significant. And copyright litigation is somewhat complicated. So there's still plenty for the plaintiff to look forward to in this situation.
Well, that's good news, I suppose. David Levine, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's fun. I'm really enjoying discussing remedies as a topic. Mm-hmm. It's not often. It's not usually fodder for radio or much else. But I'm glad to be talking about it. No, I think what Evan said about the issue of how you calculate damages here, I think is critical. You know, the parallel to contract law, is pretty stark. In order to establish damages, you need to make sure that not only are they foreseeable, but that you can establish them with some kind of certainty, usually reasonable certainty. And here, it's difficult, or it might even be impossible for the plaintiff to show that the use of this particular, picture resulted in X profits. Now, there could be comparisons that could be made. There's a lot of evidence that they might want to gather through discovery in order to draw a comparison. But even then, it's awfully tricky. I think it's a classic situation and something that you learn that you literally teach in contracts. You know, when the plaintiff chooses the remedy that they seek, the court will hold them to establishing what they need to establish for that remedy. Here, clearly, I think the plaintiff overshot wildly. And the result is the court saying, fine, this is what you want. You're not going to get it. Although, again, I also agree with Evan that that's not going to shut the plaintiff out from other damages, but damages that probably won't be nearly as lucrative as what was sought in the complaint.
Right. I mean, they really wanted to say you sold however many millions of iPhones because you used my photo. And that's a really difficult thing to prove.
Yeah, I mean, usually these kinds of issues would arise in areas like rights of publicity and trademark and stuff like that, where you can say, look, you didn't authorize, or I didn't authorize you to attach my image or my name to this product or this sale. To try to, then link it to the fact that you did it and you generated X dollars is often a bridge too far, and it's very difficult for plaintiffs generally to establish that, whether this plaintiff or any other.
All right. Well, Evan, we blew our own rule here by not leading with porn, but we do have a story that involves it somewhat. In the trademark arena, along with defamation and some other claims that were thrown in, and involves one of our favorite topics of people to talk about on the show, Hunter Moore. Apparently, there was a very small default judgment entered against him. Surprise, surprise, he did not appear to defend against the case. But there is, and I don't know if we would call the star of a reality show an actress, but she is on something called Storage Wars. Her name is Brandi Passante, and she showed up on Is Anyone Up? And sued over it, and actually got an injunction, which is a nice thing, and unfortunately only $750 worth of damages. Interestingly, though, because she had a trademark claim in there, she's going to be able to recover her attorney's fees from Hunter Moore, too, which is always a nice thing when you've had to sue over this kind of thing. Any thoughts on this case, Evan?
Well, I was a little confused about that because, you know, you normally attorney's fees are only, it's much more difficult to win your attorney's fees in trademark lawsuits than it is in copyright lawsuits. You know, the Lanham Act allows for the recovery of attorney's fees in exceptional cases only, whereas there was, you know, we just got through talking about the award of attorney's fees in copyright situations when you have the timely registration. So I would want to know a little bit more about what actually went down here. I mean, it's disappointing that there was such a low damages award against such willfully, I mean, there's no other way of characterizing it. I'm sure Hunter Moore himself would agree with this, of malicious conduct on his part here. So I don't think we can make a whole lot of conclusions in any event, even if we do learn a lot about the situation, because it was a default judgment, no findings on the merits on anything here. So interesting to see that Hunter Moore actually got sued, and you know, I guess it's up to anybody's own sensibilities whether they're surprised that he didn't show up to defend himself. So, right. Interesting facts, interesting situation to discuss, nonetheless.
Right. Instead, he was just making cheeky comments on Twitter about having to write her a check. Any thoughts on this, David Levine?
Yeah, I don't have much to add because, as Evan said, the default judgment means you're only getting one side of the story. I will note, though, generally speaking, that you know, when a defendant doesn't show up, there's usually a good reason, as opposed to just I don't care. You know, the cost of litigation may not be worth the price, as was the case here. So it's interesting that they took this route, but beyond that, it's hard to say much of substance on it.
All right. Well, Banksy is an artist that has an approach toward things being out there that seems to jibe pretty well with David from Dual Core's view. And I just wanted, this is kind of not really a substantive story we can talk about, but it seems to have an attitude toward fair use on the trademark front that would be in line with, say, the plaintiff in the midwife case that we were talking about earlier, that it would be a broad reading of fair use. And he has done a work of art that basically incorporates the Coke bottle and expresses the opinion that if you put an advertisement in a public space that gives you no choice whether you see it or not, it's yours. It's yours to take, rearrange. I'm reading now from his piece, and reuse. You can do what you want with it, he says. So Banksy taking an intellectual property stance is not an unusual thing. But here he's kind of squarely taken on the advertising realm that if you're going to make us watch it and see it and be subjected to the commercial ramifications of it, he's basically saying you've given us a license. Do you think he's got anything to go on here, David Levine?
Well, you know, so that's another interesting one. So, you know, if we take the you know, the ad itself, you know, on, you know, literally, of course, you know, we're going in the direction of basically saying that, you know, anything that's public, as Dave from DualCore was saying, you've abdicated all rights to. And so actually, you know, I'm curious, you know, from the perspective of someone like David, whether this is, you know, where you'd want things to head. Any advert in a public space that gives you no choice whether you see it or not is yours. It's yours to take, rearrange, and reuse. And in some sense, that might be true. But of course, what this means is that there's really nothing left from, and I'm going to get law professory here, a property interest in what you produce. So I guess I'm punting a little bit because I'm curious as to where this heads.
What do you think, David, from DualCore? You think if you're hit over the head with advertising, you should be able to use it?
I think that's like – it's a – in the physical space, that's like where property law comes in, which is a different ballgame. I do love like that image and like that message though. Like that's an image I'd seen from Banksy a while back, and I really dig it, and I'm kind of glad that you brought it up. The thing that's like hilarious about advertising to me is that like it makes me confused about things. Like, for example, like I love football, right? So I love to watch like our American football. Like I love to watch like NFL games, but like I have no interest at all in like American trucks or American beer or like any kind of beer. And so like I get really confused watching football because like that's all the advertisements, and I'm like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be watching football. So it's like I'm more interested in like the technology side where you can get like advertising that actually applies to you. Like I'm totally fine with seeing ads if it's for like something that like is relevant to my interests. But when it's like in the physical space, I think that's more of like a property law issue. Like when you're going to like mash it up or like modify it or something like that, because it's not actually your property in that case.
All right. Let's move on. Let's revisit Prism. On the privacy front. So I wanted to bring up, Derek Khanna has been on the show a couple of times. He wrote a nice piece in The Atlantic this week called "If Prism is Good Policy, Why Stop with Terrorism?" And he hearkened back to a public policy class that he took in college, and remembered that the first thing the professor did in that class was give the kids, the students, the notion to get their heads around that there was a law that they could enact that was going to save lives and reduce gas usage and help with pollution and really win-win all around. Would everyone in this room support the policy? And they all raised their hands. And then he told them all, okay, so in order to achieve all that, we're going to have to lower the national speed limit to 40 miles an hour. And of course, then everyone was not so thrilled. So jumping off from that, Derek came up with some other uses of Prism data that would accomplish a lot of great policy goals for the country, but, you know, basically threw it out to people. Is this really how you want your government to work and how we think about personal rights and what the Constitution protects? So I exchanged a couple emails with him and told him he'd written what we love here on the show, law school exam type questions in the public policy arena. So if there are public policy professors out there listening in, be sure and read David's piece. His first example is child pornography. And he goes through how easy it would be with the NSA data to do deep packet inspection and find known pornographic child porn pictures reduce child pornography, catch potential pedophiles, reduce child exploitation, all good things. But are you really willing to have the government go there? His second example is speed limits, the same one that his professor used, but talked about how much more effective Prism could be tracking phone locations in real time and potentially determining the speed of any user. And then finally, he goes to copyright infringement and illegal downloads of things via tools like BitTorrent, being able again to do deep packet inspection and identify the users who have uploaded or downloaded things without authorization. So, David Levine, what did you think about all this? And do you agree with Derek? Well, here's the thing that was really interesting to me about this piece is it was, I had a hard time saying that the things he tossed out would be bad ideas. And I think that's the slippery slope that we're on, aren't we?
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting piece. And, you know, I think, you know, again, you know, the question here is one of balancing. You know, the NSA, you know, forced to take a position on Prism has effectively taken the position, A, this has been effective, right? And B, well, if you're not a terrorist, you have nothing to hide, and don't, and trust us, we're not going to do anything with the data that you would be uncomfortable with, and most of it's going to be ignored. You know, to me, you know, what I think, you know, the challenging issue here is one of balancing, but it's also one of notice. You know, to the extent that one's terms of service say when they're, you know, using their private internet access provider, we are going to share all of your data or most of your data or a lot of your data with the government for unknown purposes or purposes that you won't know about or we may not know about. If that's disclosed up front and people sign the contract, at some level you could say, well, they agreed. Of course, whether they read it and whether they would they actually wanted to assent is another question. So I think Derek raises a really, you know, interesting and not entirely hypothetical scenario, because I think on the previous This Week in Law that I was on, I mentioned fusion centers, you know, these state level data mining operations that use a lot of public data and perhaps some private data to figure out who might be a terrorist. I mean, this activity's been going on for quite a while. You know, the issue to me boils down to that balancing, and that balancing, I think, needs to be done transparently and publicly. In other words, we need to have a national discussion about what society we want, and then policymakers need to actually hear and use the input that they get. As it stands now, the fact that all of this was done in secret makes all of these questions not necessarily hypothetical, which can cause the kinds of Fourth Amendment concerns that Derek raises. So I like the piece, this is, you know, merely, I think, a continuation of discussion that those that have been focusing on these issues and having it, perhaps this will broaden the discussion, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, I think so too. David from Dual Core, I imagine you agree with Derek Khanna that we have to be very careful about what we use, what we permit the government to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm all for privacy. Shouts out to my bros at the EFF. Those are my BFFs, LOL. And anyways, at the same time, like just take the child porn example from the piece. You know, like there are tools that are like freely available to like help guard your privacy. And so like just because the government can like sniff everyone's data doesn't mean they're going to catch the people that are actually doing bad things. You know, like people that do good things like can use those tools for privacy. People that do bad things can just as easily use those tools for privacy, and they do. It's a really awesome piece to read. Like, and I recommend that like everybody in the chat and like all the viewers like do read it, because like I enjoyed it. It definitely took me back to like finishing my poli sci degree when I was in school. I'm for, you know, for privacy and like for using the tools that are freely available to help guard your privacy.
Right. And this would be a good time to mention that if you want to read it and anything else we've been discussing today, head on over to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/218. And you'll find the links to all our stuff there. And let's make, law school exam our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. And let's move on to something near and dear to David Levine's heart. You've been doing a lot of work on the trade secret front, David, particularly in the area of fracking, which we all get to giggle and laugh about the funny phrase that has come to represent hydraulic fracturing, which is something done in trying to obtain natural gas deposits, correct?
Yeah, so it's a technology that is designed to free natural gas resources from rock and other mineral deposits that heretofore have been inaccessible technologically.
Right. So from tracking,
which
to
is a
fracking
totally non-commercial response. Yeah, exactly.
Right. How does trade secrets tie into all this? I know this is a big deal in your state, North Carolina, right now.
So there are, you know, about 15 odd states that have been identified to have significant natural gas, untapped natural gas resources. And what's happening in a nutshell is that, like in many other areas, the industries which are private, that are engaging in this activity, are claiming that some of what they do and the most controversial parts of what they do, I think, are in fact trade secrets, meaning that this information would not be available not only to the public, but also wouldn't be available. And this is the argument that the industry is making in a variety of places, including North Carolina, to regulators. So what does this mean specifically? The chemical composition of the fluids used to engage in fracking may be, and that's the key word, damaging to groundwater supplies. So there could be seepage of chemicals into groundwater, which could lead to health effects. There may be leakage of gas into the air and other places that could cause environmental harms and safety harms. Those concerns are concerns that are of public interest. But in order to assess the severity of the concerns, or indeed more specifically, if they exist at all, one needs access to the chemical formulas. And those formulas are allegedly trade secrets. They are information that are valuable to competitors because they're not generally known. And so what's happening in a variety of places, including North Carolina, is that the chemical industry is taking a position that these trade secrets should not be shared with the public, i.e., the public should not know what the chemical composition is, because if they know it, that will lead to commercial harm for us. But even more, and in my view, much more extremely, they're taking a position that regulators should not have access to this information except in very limited scenarios. The position that I've taken, and I took this position with Mary Linden, who is an environmental law expert at St. John's, is that regulators at a minimum must have access to this information prior to fracking actually occurring, prior to the activity beginning, so that we can be sure that there aren't environmental health and safety harms, or if there are, that they're reasonable and mitigated and so forth. So it's not good enough that this information be shared with regulators after fracking occurs, because the harm would have already happened. More broadly, Mary and I have taken the position that the public should have a limited right of access as well, so that we know as a public that our natural resources are being used appropriately. What's happening right now, which is why this is such a hot issue and it's taken up a lot of my time over the summer, is that regulators are struggling with how to balance the commercial interest of the entities engaging in fracking with the public interest. And so the North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission, of which I've been asked to join there, and I have joined their trade secret proprietary information study group, is trying to figure out what the proper balancing of those interests are. My view is that the balance has to strongly favor public disclosure for reasons I've already mentioned, but the chemical industry has taken the opposite position. And so trying to find a middle ground that serves all those interests is what states are dealing with.
Right. And you also wrote an interesting piece in Slate last month about something we've discussed on the show recently, and that is the espionage between countries appropriating one another's technology, and specifically China. All the news that has come out lately about the Chinese military's efforts to obtain Western technology, specifically in the aeronautics field, and that trade secrets on the international front is really important to address those concerns. But once again, if you make the trade secret protection too severe, then you're going to wind up potentially damaging the water table back here in the U.S., aren't you?
Right. So this is a really complicated issue. The piece I wrote in Slate a few weeks ago basically made the point that we've got to be careful not to overreact to the Chinese cyber espionage issue. I mean, you know, clearly, I think, you know, most people in the United States would agree that we don't want the Chinese military having access to information that U.S. companies hold that are trade secrets and involve weapons of mass destruction and things like that, because we have legitimate concerns that China might use that information in ways that would go against our national interest. They could share it with North Korea. You could go down a list of horribles. And so clearly that's a problem. My concern is that trade secrecy and, in fact, strengthening trade secret law is probably not the solution because the law is already pretty strong. And my example of that is see the fracking battle, which is going on right now, although there are many others. But more specifically, that if we do make trade secret law stronger by increasing the penalties, by making it easier to allege that someone has misappropriated a trade secret, we could have bad impacts here, not only on transparency, but we could kill off new legitimate forms of information gathering like corporate intelligence, which is legitimate, or also and even more specifically and more broadly, we could deter people from sharing knowledge. My primary motivator in the work that I do is that I believe that the sharing of knowledge in legitimate and new ways ultimately makes the world a better place. We can solve problems that we have. And I do believe that truth will out, which is why I'm sympathetic ultimately to ways to update copyright law to allow more information flows. But here you've got very specific and very high level concerns that go literally to life and death issues. And when we face as a country life and death issues, as in PRISM, a lot of people take the position of we need to do whatever we can do to prevent that harm, even if it means, and this is my concern, undermining the very principles that make this a country that we want to live in. And so the trade secret issue is one that the White House and that Congress is going to be dealing with. It's also one that apparently is being negotiated in the still hyper-secret Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which I continue to try to get information about. And so trade secrecy is one of these classic under-the-radar issues that are vitally important. And I just hope, frankly, again, I'm happy that you had me on so I could talk about it, but I also hope that the media picks up on this issue because your access to information is largely being governed by the commercial interests of entities that create the harms. This is circular, that make you want to have the information. And that makes me very nervous.
Right. Yeah, excellent point. Hey, David from Dual Core, I can't have you on the show without getting to our hacking story this week involving Andrew Orenheimer, Weave, a.k.a. Weave, who has been sentenced, as we've discussed in previous shows, to 41 months in prison and a $73,000 fine involving charges related to his activities in scraping an AT&T site for public information that was available there and making that information public. It was a security hole, basically, that he exploited. And so now he has been charged and sentenced under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And an appeal is now pending, and he's got some really excellent pro bono counsel working for him, including Oren Kerr, another law professor and a prolific writer over at the Volokh Conspiracy, who has filed the opening brief on appeal in, I believe, the Third Circuit, the trial having taken place in New Jersey. So what Oren Kerr has argued in his brief is that this case goes to the core of whether it is a crime to visit a public website. And if it's allowed to stand, then yes, it is under the CFAA. So not only do we have some legislators who are trying to amend the CFAA in Washington with Aaron's Law, et cetera, here we have a court that's being asked, a federal appellate court, being asked to interpret the law in a way that will hopefully shed some light on unauthorized or exceeding access to a computer. I know this is a lot of legally fraught stuff, David, but I'm wondering what your take on Weave's whole predicament is.
I think it's a huge bummer. Basically, what he did is add one to a number and collected information that was public on the internet. So, I mean, it's like the same thing, like when you go to like a local Iowa County webpage and it's got, you know, like ID equals 104 on it. If you like collect the data off of that public website, then add one and make it 105, you get a new page. And if you collect that public data, like, why is that a criminal offense? So it's really a bummer that that it's kind of come down like this, but we do need reform on the CFAA. It's a hugely outdated act, and it's very overreaching, I think. You know, like, pretty much everybody has violated the CFAA in their life. Like, for example, one of my favorite Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violations is, like, associating to an open Wi-Fi access point. Like, if you walk down the street and your phone, like, hops on a neighbor's Wi-Fi and they have not, like, consented to you that it's okay for you to get on that, you're literally in violation of the CFAA. For anybody that's like watching or like in the chat room, if you're really interested in this particular case and this issue, both Marsha Hoffman from the EFF and Oren Kerr gave a really rad talk at ShmooCon this year. I'm pretty sure the video is up online, but definitely recommend like checking it out. It's a pretty awesome talk.
Great. Thanks for that. Hey, David Levine, I know that you need to run. We're going to let you go and wind up the show here. But we have really appreciated your joining us. We love your show, Hearsay Culture. We talked about Derek Khanna earlier and his great article in The Atlantic. You had him on as a guest recently. Anyone else you want to let our listeners know they should check out over at Hearsay Culture?
Yeah, sure. I mean, thanks. And, you know, like I said, I'm mutual fans. I've listened to your show running and driving and watching. And so I appreciate it. Yeah, Derek was a great guest. Just this past week, I had Dave Opterbeck, who's a professor of Seton Hall Law, on discussing literally what we were just talking about with PRISM and the FISA courts and what those mean. Upcoming guests include Ron Epstein from Epicenter IP. He is a non-practicing entity in patent world, which is one way of identifying what others call patent trolls. And so we're going to be talking about that issue. There's also other guests coming up. Ellen Broad, who was from Australia's Digital Alliance, will be on. Phil Napoli, a professor of Fordham Law, who's written extensively on communications issues. Tim Jordan, from England, who also writes on these issues, and a variety of others. So, I'm actively recording shows over the next couple of weeks or airing over the summer. And I encourage anyone who enjoys This Week in Law and hasn't heard the show to tune in at hearsayculture.com. And it's also on iTunes through Stanford's Center for Internet Society. It's been a lot of fun. And it's fun to be on the other side of the table and actually receive questions. But then I have to do a different kind of thinking. But thanks for having me on. And Denise, again, I look forward to having you on as well. And Evan.
Yeah, it's been so great. We're huge fans of your show. You should also follow David at Hearsay Culture on Twitter. And we look forward to all that great programming you have.
Thank you so much, Denise. And by the way, I just want to say, because I can't leave without addressing the CFAA, which I think has been an unmitigated disaster. Recognize mm-hmm. that this question of authorized access has only become more complicated with recent court decisions like WEC. So basically, anything between the person wearing the stereotypical trench coat and saying bad things and doing mean things and breaking stuff, which we say, well, that's clearly a CFAA violation, or the employee for a company that's accessing, and we say that that's clearly not. Everyone between that, it's unclear what's authorized and what isn't. So it's unfortunate that's what the law is, but hopefully it can be resolved. So I'm sorry, as a law professor, I had to get that in. But thanks again for having me on.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry I have to run, but I look forward to being on again in the future if you'll have me.
We look forward to having you on again, too. And I just want, I know you need to run, but I know you also wanted to talk about Google Reader. You just want to bid it a fond farewell?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. I've been, and I appreciate it. I've been using RSS, as many of your listeners and many have, for the last several years. I still find it a better way to keep an eye on the news that I would keep an eye on than Twitter, as much as I enjoy Twitter. But, I want to, ultimately, this is going to sound like apple polishing, but I do want to thank, pun intended, I guess, I want to thank Google for putting the Google Reader product out there. As much as I'm disappointed that they got rid of it, they're a business and they have have a right to make those decisions. But I think Google Reader really established a wonderful way for people that want to keep abreast of a variety of issues to have an easy interface to do it in a mobile way that was clean and effective. I'm pleased to see other companies taking up that mantle and improving their products or trying to fill the void. But I will miss Google Reader. And as much as I'm disappointed that they're gone, I hope that Google will continue to make honest efforts to increase information access, which is why also, the Google Book Search issue, which you had mentioned in the rundown, is an important one. Their efforts to attempt to make information more accessible, I think ultimately is a positive thing. And Google Reader was part of it. I've moved on to Feedly, which hopefully will serve my purposes. But thank you, Google, and thank you, Google Reader. And thank you, Denise, for giving me the opportunity to bid it a fond adieu.
You too, David. Have a great day and a great weekend.
Thanks a lot. Thanks again, Evan and David. David from David Core, pleasure meeting you as well.
Take care.
See you, David.
Awesome. So there's just one other substantive story I wanted to get to before we go to our tip and resource of the week. It's on the patent front. And that's because we've gone from tracking to fracking. We've got to go back to tracking, I think, one more time, because AT&T got a patent to monitor and track file sharing traffic. I thought this was pretty fascinating, and it sort of follows well from the story we had last week about the BitTorrent vice president, Matt Mason, who said, if you're using BitTorrent for piracy, you're doing it wrong. Apparently, AT&T hasn't quite bought into that and has a patent now on technology that's going to be able to tell not only when you're using BitTorrent, but what you are using it for. So I'm sure there are lots of people that would be interested in licensing and or having ISP AT&T perform those inspections and analysis of data for them. David from Dual Core, what do you think about this patent?
I have a problem with a lot of patents, and like this one is basically just saying like, hey, like we can like do analysis on data that we've acquired. And so I'm like, you know, big deal. Like there's lots of software that can do analysis on data that's been acquired. But I guess if like that's the way that they need to like set things up to do business for themselves, like that's just going to happen, I guess. But I don't know, like overall, like I feel like a lot of patents are rubbish. So I'm not particularly fond of this one either.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It seems like this has made its way past the gatekeepers at the patent office. But of course, there are other ways to challenge patents down the road. Certainly, this is a prize I think a lot of people have had their eyes on for some time. Evan, don't you agree?
Well, sure. Yeah, this technology is pretty important from the perspective of those who go around fighting so-called piracy. And it should come as no surprise that AT&T may have an interest in this for, you know, it wouldn't be hard for them to come up with a valid network management related interest that they would have in you know, having exclusive rights to this technology. The most intriguing aspect to this story that I see is, wouldn't it be funny if AT&T read the claims in this patent to be infringed by some of the technology that Prenda Law uses to go out and find those who are infringing on copyright using BitTorrent protocol, and that Prenda Law finds itself as a defendant in a patent lawsuit for something like that? That's what I would like to see. So when I think about that, I'm like, yes, go AT&T, take this patent, run with it. And, you know, you see, it's like seeing two people you don't like fight against each other, you know?
Yeah, troll so hard.
Right. That's right.
Very good.
Exactly. I want to see that, and I want to see the whole Prism scenario and other technology the NSA might be using thrown up as prior art here.
That would be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, they were tracking first. So just thought that was interesting. Speaking of the NSA, we have a great resource of the week for you. Again, I really encourage you to, you know, head on over to our delicious links or just to the PressFreedomFoundation.org, Trevor Timm's site, and check out their white paper on protecting your privacy in the age of NSA surveillance. It is a really comprehensive piece. Again, it's a little bit depressing because what it really points out is how non-mainstream a lot of the really effective technologies are, and how, you know, you basically have to be David from Dual Core running Ubuntu and a host of other nice, safe software to avail yourselves of all of these security benefits. But you've got to check it out anyway. It is a great, great piece. It is by, let me see, who wrote this? Micah Lee over at the Freedom of Press Foundation. So he goes into, you know, end-to-end encryption, the pros and cons of things like PGP and off-the-record chat. How you can anonymize your location with Tor, and basically just where things stand now as far as being able to do things with privacy using modern communication tools. Dual Core, David, did you check this out? And are you already running all the things he recommends?
So like it's actually a pretty cool article. There's another paper that I like that's not as current as this one. I think it was like last updated in 2006. I posted it in the IRC channel a little bit ago, but the paper is called How to Exit the Matrix. And if you just Google for it, it actually talks about anonymity and like a lot of different aspects of life. So it's, you know, there's like network anti-forensics and like system anti-forensics and stuff like that, but also things like acquiring like a PO box without having it tied to your real identity and stuff like that. So it's kind of a neat read. Again, it's just a free paper that's online. If you Google how to exit the matrix, like it'll come up at the top, or at least it comes up in the top of mine. But yeah, like, I mean, the thing that's awesome to me is that there's all this software that helps protect your privacy and like help keep the things that you care about, like just to you, or like only shared with the people that you want to share with. And it's free. Like, that's amazing. And it's open source, so you can like audit the source code, easy to Trojan, but also easy to like detect when it's been Trojaned. There's a bunch of other stuff out there. Like, I mean, hackers in general tend to be fairly concerned with privacy and anonymity. There's a guy out there by the name of The Gruk, G-R-U-G-Q. And he's done like a pretty cool talk on like anonymity through operational security or OPSEC. And so if you like go and look for his talk, I think it's something like WooFTPD, jail is for WooFTPD or something like that. But anyways, like that paper that you linked is an awesome read. And then there's a bunch of other material out there. And if anybody wants to like holler at me online via IRC or Twitter or whatever, like I'm always happy to talk more about anonymity and share resources and stuff like that.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much for those additional pointers. Micah Lee ends this white paper by saying the challenge of the new cypherpunk movement is to make secure and verified end-to-end encryption accessible to everyone and turned on by default. So all you hackers out there, you know, let's work toward that goal, because the rest of us will tell you there's a market for it, but not all of us can do Ubuntu, so or just are ready to go there and do it just yet. Our tip of the week is ripped from the headlines this week, and it is it involves the Zimmerman trial that has been going on, and the expert witness, I'm sorry, I think he was actually not an expert witness. He was someone who taught criminal justice to Zimmerman. And one of the points in the trial they were trying to get out was the stand your ground defense and the defendant here's knowledge of that defense and how he got an A in that course when he took it. So they had this witness on the stand, and they brought him in via Skype. And the trial, I guess, is being televised. And unfortunately, they brought him on you know, it was like being on the live stream here at Twit, but having everybody's private Skype information thrown up, nobody gave that any thought, just showed the Skype screen while they were connecting with him. And then in the middle of the testimony, people who'd been watching the live feed of the trial started calling in. So, you know, yeah, they were really, really silly not to set it so that only the witness's contacts could call. But I think even then, you know, if you're a trial lawyer, you've got to worry about, you know, Joe Blow who's traveling and wants to say hi and Skypes in while the witness is on the stand and interrupts the proceedings. So Skype for the courtroom, maybe it needs some new settings, but our tip is for trial lawyers and just being savvy about what's going to happen if you're Skyping someone in and you let their username go out to the world. It's something we're pretty try to be pretty careful about here at Twit. Evan, did you think this was as sort of, oh my goodness, as I did?
Yeah, I mean, this was totally an amateur mistake on the part of those who were responsible for establishing this connection. I mean, there was something weird, too. It's not like it was the video that he was sending, that the witness was sending, but for I guess they were using, like, the Skype share your screen feature, because if you notice when people were calling, it was what the witness was seeing on the screen. He, you know, you could see him clicking, trying to reject those calls. So there was something weird about that as well. And so if it had been just an ordinary Skype conversation on full screen, there wouldn't have been any reason to see his username in the first place. And it would have been less disruptive without seeing all these goofy people, you know, trying to call as well, showing up on the screen. So, yeah, totally amateur mistake. Shame on them.
Right.
But it's, you know, provides us something to laugh at and to, you know, I'm sure we've all made goofy mistakes like that as well. So I should lighten up a little bit.
Yes, I think we've probably made a dozen of them in the show today, but it is fun when we can make a tip out of one of them anyway and try to help people avoid them in the future. David, any thoughts on this?
I just think it's LOL. Like, I always like when mistakes like that happen and people, you know, are sharp and catch it quickly and, like, take advantage of it in that way. I also think it would be hilarious if, like, somebody got on there and blurted out, like, I'm George Zimmerman and I'm guilty. And, like, before that gets stricken from the record, it's, like, actually on the record for some moment in time.
Yes, hopefully for just a brief moment in time.
All right, well,
this has been...
Sorry.
Yes. This has been a super fun and interesting show. Sorry about my connectivity issues. I hope we can entertain and enlighten you despite the fact that I'm on the road this week. We certainly have enjoyed meeting you, David. And tell us a little bit more about your summer tour schedule.
We've got a show in San Francisco coming up on the 16th. We'll be playing at DNA Lounge. And then we head to San Diego right after that. And we'll be playing a show there for Comic-Con on that weekend, I think the 19th, if I recall correctly, for the date. For those of us that, like, or for those of us viewers or folks in the chat that haven't checked out our stuff, we make rap music. I work with a guy in London, and we make rap music about technology and hacking and all the things that we do and love every day. But after San Diego, I go to Vegas, and we'll be there for Black Hat and EFF playing a bunch of shows and drinking all the booze and hacking all the things. So it'll be awesome.
That is awesome. And I think maybe as we bid a fond farewell to Evan here, Evan, thanks so much. And again, for being on the show and the great things you've been writing over at Internet Cases lately.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here. Yeah, really have enjoyed our conversation. Dual Core, nice to talk to you as well. So yeah, lots of fun.
I think if your British partner doesn't have any objections, we can let you play us out, David.
Oh, yeah, sweet. How do I – I don't Skype that hard. How do I – you want me to just – no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, I
virus from
there
DCI.
We go.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Nice.
Hey.
Drink yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. I love you guys.
Things. That's how we're doing it this year.
Thank you.
See you, Dilcock.
Commodore 64 can hack into NASA.
Disaster recovery requires even more discs. Put your bites up, prove it or you forfeit. Got my C64 and we blew it into orbit. M bison with eight straight perfects. Overvolt emotions make hate break circuits.
my gosh, I love this.
Thanks.
Woohoo! Shannon, thank you so much for that. And everyone else, enjoy your weekend. This is a great kickoff for Liquid Friday, and we hope you have a great one. Join us next Friday. We record every week, 11 a.m. Pacific time, 1800 UTC, right here at twit.tv. Find us on Google Plus and on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Dee Howell there. Evan is Internet Cases. Shoot us emails, Evan at twit.tv, Denise at twit.tv. Let us know what you think and what you want to hear about. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you soon.